I don't know. Listeners will notice we forgot how to do podcasts for a while. How many times would you say we fully recorded this podcast before something terrible happened?
This is the third try.
I'm pretty sure it's about 4,007. Like, we've...
At least.
Every time we've recorded this, something spectacularly technically stupid has happened. So, you're cursed, because the episode's cursed, so congrats.
Congrats on your curse, listener. Yep. It's over. It's all downhill from here.
Sorry. We gotta pass it on. Okay, so I have a list of things that happened in the meantime. It's been like a month, I think. Maybe a little bit more than a month. I mean, less time than that since the last time we tried to record that, but you don't know that because you weren't there. So there was an election.
It feels like
that sucked shit. Everyone still has coronavirus. That also sucks. I had an IUD put in and 4 straight weeks of unendurable pain. That was really cool and chill. Sam had to surprise move, which was also terrible.
I caught bofa.
Yeah, I had an episode.
Caught a bad case of bofa. Had to quarantine myself.
Yeah. So now
luckily, you know what cures bofa? Pabst Blue Ribbon Hard Coffee.
Oh, God, that's
the sponsor of this episode.
I assumed it was something.
Just kidding. I wish to God. I wish to God that was our sponsor.
She's drinking.
I do hate to spoil it for listeners. It is just like a really bad canned White Russian. Ugh. Like, that's what it is. It's milk with mystery juice in it.
She's drinking it out of a wine glass like a monster. Anything else? I don't think anything else happened. I had kind of an episode which lasted a couple weeks. It's fine. We're joined today by our new co-host, Emily Spinach, the mouse with a weird leg who lives in this fish tank now. She eats grapes all day.
A live mouse.
So everyone say hi to Emily Spinach. I named her after Teddy Roosevelt's daughter's pet snake. Suck it.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Emily Spinach. She is a mouse and she eats grapes.
I wondered why that was a familiar name.
Yeah.
My middle name is named after Teddy Roosevelt's wife. And once I asked my mom why that, and she was like, I don't know, I think about that a lot. I should have named you something meaningful, but instead I just named you after a president's wife. Thanks, Mom.
Okay.
Cool.
Cool.
The deep symbology of names.
Okay,
welcome.
Jesus Christ. All right.
Welcome to the Museum of the Vanishing Dog. All your nightmares made real. Curses laid upon you thicker with each moment. The only podcast that will turn you stark raving gay in 45 minutes or more.
Oh my God. I'm kind of afraid that this episode, after having done it so many times, it's just going to be 45 minutes of straight screaming.
Already. That's what's happening so far.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm worried it's going to get fucked up again and this is our Groundhog Day.
Oh, that we just do this episode? Maybe we could just start releasing whatever pieces actually get recorded and they just get to
work
out.
That would be a fun idea for a podcast, like the same episode, but like something horrible happens halfway through every time. So just like 30 minutes of the same information with like an increasingly unhinged and mentally ill tenor. So what we're doing.
Exactly what's happening. I meant to bring in my toy accordion to sing a song about the election where it was just going to be me screaming while I play the accordion, but I'm kind of afraid it would scare Emily Spinach now and she seems delicate.
Damn.
Yeah,
I don't want to scare Emily Spinach. I think I would be frightened.
Yeah, I just thought it would reflect how I feel.
Wait, I'm so scared of our curse, I actually do feel inclined to ask you if you hit record.
No, I did.
You hit record, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
I did too, but I had to double check, because I didn't remember. I didn't remember doing it, but I did do it. Last time, it was Audacity just... Wait, no, the first time, Audacity just crashed. So there's nothing we can even do to, like, anticipate or prevent that.
It crashed within maybe 1 minute left of recording. Like, we'd said the end.
That was the funny part.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we could have just recorded my section where I would just sound mentally ill laughing at nothing.
That's actually what has been happening the whole time.
No.
That's good. I've never been here.
Aww.
That's the real curse.
Aww. No, we're still doing it. I mean, again, I could record milk. And then I try to save it, and it'll say, like, we haven't recorded anything here for 50 years.
Sam Hinsley, I haven't heard that name in 50 years. Last time I saw her, she was rooting and scooting out into the horizon, screaming up a storm, said she had a bad case of the worms. We never saw her again.
I guess we should say our names at some point.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. I'm Sam Hinsley, the one rooting and scooting into the horizon
of all
with
her
a
worms.
Terrible case of
yeah.
scream worms.
Yeah. I'm Liz Hamilton, and that's not happening for me, but could. Who knows? I wanted to say, this is how fucking long ago we recorded this episode first.
We had a different president.
Right, we had a different president, and it was for Indigenous Peoples Day, and I had a whole bit about it. That was like a month and a half ago, but it is National Native American Heritage Month.
I was gonna, yeah, I meant to say that. We should do the land
Yeah, so I'm gonna do our land acknowledgement.
Even more relevant.
Because I meant to then, and I will now.
You got it memorized now, third time you've done it.
Jesus Christ. So I wanted to, it's Native American Heritage Month, terribly that happens during Thanksgiving, why, seems offensive, but I did want to say that, you know, it's funny to do a land acknowledgement because we're in kind of a spectral realm, but when not at the museum, Sam lives on Ojibwe, Odawa, and Potawatomi land, and I live on Luis Sueño land. So just
which, for those wondering, is respectively now called Chicago and...
Don't worry about it.
And secret.
I live in northern San Diego County.
But if you also live in Chicago, don't find me. I'll be scared. But do take note of the land that you live on. You got a free one. But also, where can people find that information if they're interested? What native land they might be.
Oh, should have written that down. There's a good website for that, and I can't remember what it is.
We'll put it on the Instagram.
We'll put it on the Instagram. There's an app where you can just, like, check whose land I live on.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Which, it's good information to know, I think. And you should know it, because, of course, you should. So, I wanted to say...
Put that on that old Instagram.
If you wanted to donate to, some people who are helping out Indigenous communities this month.
Yes.
The official Navajo Nation COVID-19 Relief Fund is excellent. The Navajo Nation has been especially hard hit by COVID-19 and also everything all the time, and it's terrible. The Native American Community Response Fund is really good. And there's also the GoFundMe for the Protect Native Elders, which sends out supplies and food to Native Elders, is really great. I also really like the Sovereign Bodies Institute for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. And there's a group called Seeding Sovereignty for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women that has a really excellent social media presence. So
great.
I would suggest following those. Just in general, I think the American racism against Indigenous people is different than the racism against many other groups of people, in that it happens kind of like with invisibility rather than hypervisibility. So it's good to try to make yourself aware of things like that. So,
yep, check those out. Good time of year to be thinking about
that. Do that instead of whatever your terrible Thanksgiving plan is.
Yeah, don't do it. Thanksgiving is canceled. I guess it'll
already have happened.
It'll be after. I started to imagine a reality where I, like, edit the episode completely within 12 hours of recording it, and then I remembered that I have executive dysfunction.
Yeah, it's...
And that's impossible.
It's fine. So that's what I got.
All right. God. What usually happens now? I guess we can also talk about the conceit of our podcast. If you're new, what an unfortunate episode for you to enter on. We're really
so sorry.
We're at the height of our distraught mental illness being exacerbated by the year 2020, and really at the basin of our game as a semi-professional podcaster.
Yeah, I should say we're both disorganized on the best of days and profoundly mentally ill, and it's just been a really weird, hard time. So
we're sick. Well, what we have is a sickness of the soul.
Also, like, some psychiatric problems. maybe some super definable psychiatric problems, but don't worry about it.
No, I have a curse.
So, plus Sam keeps stealing all those cursed amulets. So we're trying really hard, but it's a rough time.
So on this podcast, we're letting you into the inner professional workings of the fine institution that is the Museum of the Vanishing Dog, where we were until recently interns. We were recently promoted due to, I think, a vast number of deaths amongst the employees. Maybe. That's conjecture. We were recently promoted mysteriously to curators, which is crazy because...
we don't know anything.
Listen to us. Okay. So what we do on each episode is take turns designing, formulating, and then introducing to each other an entirely new exhibit. Because there's a lot of space here and a lot of old, outdated exhibits that need refurbishing. And also, museums are just kind of stupid and they should suck less.
Yeah. We're helping to renovate the museum before it gets reopened. It's closed to the public at the moment, but...
It's a special museum and we're making it different, better.
Yeah.
Bloodier, slimier than other museums.
Definitely slimier.
Now, and I do say museums suck from a place of love for them. For sure. They just, you know, they've got a lot of issues. That
Yeah, so every week one of us does an exhibit. This week is your week, so that's exciting. Mm. So let's do your exhibit. I'll pretend not to know, and in all fairness, it's been a while since you told me.
Yeah, originally this exhibit had a twist for Liz to be surprised by. This will now be the third time she has experienced the twist, so please enjoy both of us trying to feign any will to live at all, but also it's also feign the ability to properly record this podcast. So our new exhibit, if you'll follow me, Liz, is near the food court. Astute listeners may recall the food court being described in episode 5, The Mellified Man.
Yep.
It's also home to our Museum of the Vanishing Dog coin dispenser.
Yep.
Liz, you probably already have a couple of those coins on you.
Yeah, I do. So for people who don't know, many of our exhibits operate via coin system. So we have I imagine like a penny pressing machine. Yeah?
Yes, yes. You get to watch them pop out, and they're pretty. They all have a patina of age on them. They've been with the metal is old, and they've got a serrated edge like a quarter, and a running dog on them. A common logo you'll see around the museum. It's a system for display that we adopted from the more accessible location, the House on the Rock, a physical place that you can visit in Wisconsin when there's not a pandemic. It prevents wear and tear on automatons and other, intensive mechanical displays. Yep. Instead of having them running constantly, they just run when you put in a fun coin. Yep. I just think that's a fun fact. As far as I know, the House on the Rock kind of invented that system, and I think it's really smart.
Yeah.
They might not have, but...
I bet they'd say that they did, even if they didn't.
No, they certainly would. They're insane. Not that you'll have any use for those coins today. Our next exhibit is a run-of-the-mill historical reconstruction. Aww. So you won't have any use for them. So let me show you around this new one. Dear Liz, in the town where I was born...
A weird way to start. Go on.
Especially since I'm just speaking to you.
Yeah.
In the town where I was born, there's a fine place called the Kentucky History Museum. That's in the town of Frankfort, the Kentucky capital, fifth smallest capital in the United States. The museum is arranged in a way that I really enjoy. It focuses most on the homes of people throughout history instead of events. It uses homes as the timeline. In it, you can find different types of Native American structures, frontier cabins, antebellum parlors, and even a riverboat, all bisected like dollhouses, so that they can be peered into or walked through. This exhibit begins much the same, but in a relatively modern setting, a mid-century Kentuckian farmhouse. Now, when I say farmhouse, don't imagine something fancy like maybe other more affluent southern states may have. It's much like many other Kentuckian farmhouses throughout history. It's just on the edge of disrepair, and it's humble, but sturdy and sweet. A big family rest here. 8 adults and 3 children. The floral wallpaper is peeling, the wood is subject to mold and lichen, the metal roof curls and rusts at the corners, but it's nonetheless a fine and a loved home. Facing you, the viewer, it is lacking an entire wall. It's lit by a couple meager electric fixtures and an array of kerosene lamps. Inside, a kitchen outfitted in cast iron and speckleware. Gun racks bearing rifles and shotguns. A pitcher, likely holding some recently dipped well water. And no bathroom. That's a separate structure, one you can also peer into. Next to a wooden bench seat with a circular hole, there's a bucket filled with Sears catalogs.
Hate it.
To the other side of the house is a small well, and that's a very real, I don't know if it's a southern thing or just a Kentuckian thing, but like when you got the Sears catalog in, you were like, ah, yes, free toilet paper. That's Kentucky culture. Not anymore, not per se, but
not unless you want it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, we can bring it back, but for the generation before us, it was that was just commonplace, using catalogs as toilet paper. To the other side of the house, there's a small well. While it can't be said for sure, this is a fair approximation of the Sutton farmhouse, deep in western Kentucky. The home was just outside of the 150-person town of Kelly, but the news would say what transpired there happened in the larger Hopkinsville, out of laziness or misinformation. Much like in the Kentucky History Museum, a few of the family members are represented here as stiff waxen figures with rooted hair and glass eyes. A chair rocks slowly back and forth with an old bearded man in it, by a stove fireplace flanked by ceramic jugs. A young girl darns socks. A man in bib overalls stands mid-chop between the porch and the outhouse, frozen. A speaker plays the sound of wood splitting, easy conversation, and a kettle boiling. A bedraggled farm dog sleeps in death-like peace on the rug. It's the picture of what many out-of-staters would describe as hillbilly or redneck life. To these folks, it's a quiet evening. A hot one, too. It's late summer 1955. The plaque in front of the display reads, "The Kelly Hopkinsville Encounter," in a solemn serif font. You can almost touch the figures in the display if you lean against the railing.
So should I lean against the railing and touch them? I feel like we're doing really well in always having wax humans in our exhibits lately.
There's a lot of uncanny wax humans in general in our museum. I like them. They're fun. I'm very, very impacted by one of my earliest memories at the Frankfort Kentucky History Museum. They have like a replica coal mine with all this like shiny painted black plaster and like old fake lamps, and in the back of it, and it's like really poorly lit, so it's like actually creepy and scary. In the back of it, there's this one like wax man holding a lamp, and he's got like a coal mining helmet on, and he's cut at the waist so that he can swivel, and he just swivels back and forth, like swinging his lamp and like peering around, and that like so horrified and intrigued me as a child. That definitely inspired the format of this exhibit. He really stuck with me. And also there was a goat. The riverboat that I talked about, there was a goat on it that its head would like look back and forth eternally.
Yeah, it sounds like a pre-movie franchise Pirates of the Caribbean, which is full of terrifying automatons doing very odd things. Some of which are still in there and are deeply disturbing.
Yeah, the goat, last time I went, like a year ago, the goat doesn't work anymore. And it's actually my dream to offer to fix it for them. I feel like they would let me, and I definitely could.
I feel like you would make it do something weird, though, right?
No, maybe. But, like, I don't know, they're a small museum, and they're nice. I feel like I could be like, hey, why don't you let me repair that mechanical goat for you? That's my dream.
They probably wouldn't get too mad if you just made it go, hello.
I put a recorder in there, motion activated recorder. It might be fixed by now, though. I haven't been for a long time. Anyway, there's a slot on the informational plaque in front of the exhibit with text under it in capitalized pale green lettering. It reads, "Let Night Fall."
Let Night Fall! Let's do it. Okay, I'll put a coin in. one of my many that are weighing down my pockets.
Good thing you brought them, even though I said you wouldn't need them. You drop in a coin after taking in the rural scenery. The lights dim, the spotlight turns off on the man chopping wood, and the sound ceases. Crickets and tree frogs raise their din. A plastic moon lights up in the back of the display. A thin waxing crescent, just as it was August 21st, 65 years ago. Owls begin to hoot. The text you just read now glows faintly, and so does some more you hadn't seen before. Tonight, this family will receive strange visitors. Several things throughout the display are glowing now, revealing a second scene not visible before. Embers glow in the stove and fireflies flick on and off outside. But more interestingly, enormous eyes begin to fade into view. They surround the home. They're perched on the roof and huddled by the window to the children's room, peering.
I'm so excited.
Of the three surviving members of the Kelly family today, two have refused to ever speak of this night. Based on police accounts and what little witness testimony remains, this is what transpired. It would later be known amongst you ufologists and historians as the Kelly Hopkinsville ufologists as the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter. Another coin slot lights up.
Okay, I'll put in another coin.
Another coin? Don't spend it all in one place. Cheerful theremin music begins to play. I don't know. That's what I imagined.
Yeah, and so it shall be.
It's canon. The informational plaque clicks and lifts open. Inside, very small golf clubs and brightly colored golf balls.
Okay, so when you say really small golf clubs, can you describe that?
Like a normal golf club, but if it were for a child.
Okay, so like...
Not like miniature, but too small for you to use comfortably.
Right, I mean, I'm 6 feet tall, I'd be doubled at the waist.
Yeah, yeah, that's the plan.
It's just to give me and my 30-year-old back a lot of problems tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, like hostile architecture, but just for Liz.
I love it. Could we also have a lot of low-hanging things that will get caught in my very curly hair at the same time?
Yeah, low ceilings that are covered in Velcro. Which I think is what your hell would be.
When I used to go to camp over the summers, it was always a mean trick my friends would make on me and making me sleep in one of the bottom bunks, because I would just sit up and all of my hair would get stuck to the top of the bunk bed. And every morning, we'd have to just sort of fight my way out. It was not kind.
For the unawares, Liz has big, poofy hair.
And a lot of it.
And it's very beautiful, but I imagine if she did walk under a Velcro overhang, we would have to put her down.
You just have to shave my head.
No, it'd be the end. We'd have to...
Just so you'd have to kill me?
It'd be humane.
Oh, bummer.
The guardrail in front of the display hisses and retracts into the floor, and powerful backlights, black lights, not just backlights, but black lights, like at a party, turn on in the ceiling, bathing the scene in bowling alley style neon stars and planets that were invisible before. An enormous sign flicks on above you, so searingly neon, you immediately look up to see it. It's the Kelly Hopkinsville Blacklight Mini Golf Encounter.
I'm so excited.
Yes, God.
Okay, I'm ready with my incredibly tiny...
I pass you a lime green mini golf club.
Thank you.
And a pink ball.
Excellent.
We're at hole one. Let me open my dice app.
All right, some of the times we've done this, I've been really good at mini golf, but other times I have not been.
So we'll determine your par
by
dice, because we're not actually playing the game due to quarantine.
Right.
However, it is a real place. We're there, but, you know, we don't want to get our hands all over it.
Right.
We want to get our nasty, grubby COVID hands on the golf clubs. That's for visitors someday.
And, you know, I haven't played mini golf since probably 1997, so as far as you know, I'm really good at it.
The year I was born. Coincidence? Absolutely not. So we're at hole one. Step right in. You are inside the display now. There is a knock at the door, and it's Billy Ray Taylor, or a shitty animatronic of him anyway. Yeah. He looks unusually worked up. His hat and eyebrows bounce up and down as he tells you a gall-darned spaceship has landed in the holler. Specifically, he is quoted as seeing a flying saucer, real bright, with an exhaust all the colors of the rainbow. The family disregards him. He's a characteristically sorry feller, quote, who loves to tell tales when he gets home.
Billy Ray.
The Waxon family. Oh, Billy Ray. The Waxon family in the farmhouse size.
Oh, Billy you Ray. Idiot.
This hole's easy. Send a golf ball between Billy Ray's feet to shoo him back out the door. It rolls out. Let's see what your par was. That's a pretty simple one. So surely nothing too bad. Yeah, that's a hole in one.
I'm so good at golf.
So now we'll walk on to hole two. After Billy Ray is out the door, the clock on the wall accelerates to show that it is now 8 o'clock, an hour later. The dog jostles to standing and begins to bark. A scruffy animatronic, not unlike those in our Immortal Dog exhibit,
which I highly recommend you check out if you have it,
light begins to filter in through the windows, emanating from the field. The dog whimpers in fear. You look out the window in the direction that the animatronic family's heads have swiveled. The following scene, as described by the family patriarch Lucky Sutton, unfolds in black-lit neon. Approaching from the fields was a strange glow. As it came nearer, they could make out what seemed to be a small man, though a man not much like any they had ever seen before. He was about 3.5 feet tall, with an oversized head that was almost perfectly round, and arms that extended almost to the ground. The huge hands had talons at the end of the fingers. The eyes were much bigger than human eyes and glowed with a yellowish light. They were directed neither to the front nor to the side, but about midway between. The whole creature was seemingly made of silver metal that gave off an eerie light in the darkness, like light from the radium dial on a watch. The creature's hands were raised now, as if someone had told him he was about to be robbed. He was approaching the house slowly, moving toward the back door.
Okay, teeny tiny metal robot. Big talons.
At this point, the family began to fire their rifles and shotguns at the creature.
not my first impulse, but okay.
Welcome to Kentucky, but you will instead use the one weapon I have given you. From the living room, fire your golf ball out the back door and up the provided ramp into the hideous creature accosting you.
Okay, so am I aiming past it, or right just at it. Am I trying
right
to hit it?
You said the rule for you said.
Okay,
the rule yourself.
All
right, right for him,
right for all the right. Dick.
Let's see what? Oh my! Another hole in one. This is crazy.
I'm so good at golf.
That shouldn't happen. Right, mark that down.
Excellent genital aim.
When you hit it, the creature's fluorescent skin brightens even further, and it does a dramatic backflip and then disappears. This is apparently what actually happened when they hit it with their guns.
I love it. So do they think they actually hit it, or was it?
It seemed like it was doing it in response to the bullets, according to their eyewitness accounts. Like, it seemed like they did, like, I think they even said it made, like, a metallic sound when it hit him.
Oh, fun.
We'll see when I get to that part of my notes. I think I remember that. Okay. When a direct blast from a 12-gauge shotgun had no effect, Lucky made an obvious decision. He would leave the things alone. The man went back into the house to try to think what to do next.
And was it just the one that they saw, or was it more?
At this
one?
Point, it was just the one.
Okay.
Hole three. We go outside. As you pass through the door, you feel something comb briskly through your hair from above.
No.
It's the Velcro ceiling I've made to destroy
no!
you.
I have to die now.
It'll be humane. Quote from from Close Encounter, one of my sources. The men decided to go out, specifically Close Encounter at Kelly, the Bible source for this topic. The men decided to go outdoors and see whether they had actually hit the creature. As they started out the front door, there occurred one of the most talked about and terrifying incidents of the story. Taylor went through the doorway first. As he stood under the small overhanging roof, about to step down into the yard, those behind him in the hall saw a claw-like hand reach down and touch his hair. They screamed at him, and Aline Sutton seized him to pull him back into the house. Lucky, close behind Taylor, pushed past him into the yard, turned the 12-gauge shotgun toward the creature on the overhang, fired, and knocked it over the roof. "There's one up in the tree, too," Billy Ray said. "It was on the limb of the maple tree, to the right as you leave the house." Both Lucky and Taylor shot at that one, knocking him off the limb. He floated to the ground. They shot at him again, and he, too, scurried off into the weeds. Almost at the same moment...
Hmm? I have questions about the verb floated.
Yeah, they'll get into a little more detail with the way they describe that, because it is one of the most unusual parts of the account.
Okay. For now, I'm imagining, like, a Mary Poppins style.
Pretty much. Almost at the same moment, around the northwest corner of the house, right in front of Lucky, came another one. Or the same one that had been knocked over the ridgepole. They weren't sure. Whenever they came toward the house, they had an upright posture, walking slowly with their hands raised. Talking to Mr. Ledwith the next morning, Mrs. Langford said that she thought the slow approach and raised hands meant that the creatures were trying to establish communication. When struck by shots on a tree limb or on the roof, they performed their fantastic trick of not falling but floating toward the ground. But whenever they had been knocked over while on the ground by a shot, they had, quote, flipped, in the Sutton's phrase. They moved differently. They lowered their hands to the ground and ran very rapidly, except that the arms seemed to furnish most of the propulsion. The thin legs, quote, as spindly as broom handles, seemed to be used only for balance.
So they were just doing, like, walking like the dumb monkeys when they were trying to prove that they weren't gonna harm them?
Yeah, it does kind of seem that way, like it was some sort of pantomime. Like, look, we're like you. Please don't kill.
Okay, I love
it. Maybe. I was kind of stuck on the best concept for holizing that scene.
a very troubling word.
I mean, it sounds like we're just going to have you shoot some more golf balls at him. So
I'm aiming just up towards the trees or the roof?
Yeah, you're trying to get it onto the roof.
It's like a more challenging move.
Yeah, I didn't say it'd be easy.
Right, again, imagine the sort of velocity I'd need to be bent double and get enough power to get it straight up onto the roof.
You're just gonna have to...
I mean, I might as well just pick it up and throw it.
You gotta lean in. Lean in, hashtag girl boss it. He's throwing it onto the roof. We'll see how many tries it takes for you to throw a golf ball onto the roof. Oh, damn. It's like there's something wrong with this. That was also technically a hole in one.
Or I'm so good at golf.
Yeah, I guess you're really good at
mini
golf.
How athletically inclined I am. I'm always like, no, let's do a sport.
You know, I heard Liz Hamilton can throw a golf ball onto a roof in one try.
Hey, I did catch that bat with a funnel. That's almost the same.
Oh, no, you're very strong. You're very strong. You ripped that bat right in half with your bare hands. I saw it happen.
No, I didn't. I made sure.
No, you were very nice to the bat.
It was like when I caught that hummingbird. It took so much to not squish it, but I didn't.
You were very, very gentle in the way you immediately shoved them into your mouth and swallowed them. And it was just as upsetting the second time with the hummingbird.
Yeah, but you could hear its wings.
You're like the little old lady who swallowed a spider. You ate the bat so that it would eat the hummingbird.
Yeah. I just think it's funny.
Right. Hole 4. As described by Davis in Close Encounter, quote, "Except for the big glowing yellow eyes, the creatures were the same color all over. In the dark, this was a phosphorescent or luminescent glow, but when a light was turned on them, this changed to a dull metallic look. The body surface gave the witnesses the impression that it was skin. If it was some kind of a spacesuit, as had been suggested, it covered them up completely. The glow of the bodies increased when they were shot or shouted at, as if noise affected the luminosity. The strange triangular ears, large, floppy, and wrinkled like leather and pointed up, were seen by the women as extended somewhat outward, by the men as closer to the head. There was no hair."
So, like the difference between, like, a house elf and, like, a kitty cat?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, kind of, like, up, down. Like, if you were holding your hands, palm forward, like, hands to the side, hands up. Like, you were doing bunny ears with your hands. And it is interesting whether, like, like, just theoretically, whether that was a difference in perception. Like, if it was just that the women saw them less because the women were, like, not trying as hard to shoot them with guns. Or if it was, like...
So are you saying animals don't respond well when you yell at them and try to shoot them with guns?
Yeah, like, I don't know if it was just that the women saw less of the creatures, or perhaps that the creatures didn't have their ears, like, at the alert when they were not being shot at. That's interesting. I think they talk more about the ears later in my notes. We'll see. I don't remember anything I wrote down because I wrote it down like 2 months ago.
You wrote it down 3 years ago.
3 years ago. There was no hair, no indication of sex, and they gave off no smell.
Not true. Hit it in the dick.
Yeah. The creatures made no noise at any time. The mouth, if such it was, never opened, and they made no sound when moving, although the weeds and bushes rustled when the creatures fled into them. Hmm. You now walk a little further into the yard. The mural of woods on the facing wall glows sickly green. A neon goblin figure pops out of the floor and begins to scoot pathetically toward you on tracks. It has enormous bat-like ears. Quickly, you have to decimate it with a golf ball before it gets to you.
Again, at this instance, I think I might as well just use the bat and not the ball.
I mean... You gotta use the ball.
Sorry, I guess I'm breaking the rules of golf.
You are. I gave you one because you already. I let you throw it on the roof.
Okay.
That one took you 4 tries.
Oh,
damn!
My confidence got shaken.
4 tally marks on there for you. That's crazy. You got 3 holes in 1 because I'm rolling dice. Like that's wild. I mean, 1 dice, 1 digital dice.
Digital dice,
for free on the internet. Shout out random.org. Sponsor us with all that dice money you guys probably have rolling in.
Yeah, should I try to incorporate a chance element into the super crazy episode I'm
writing? Yes! Yes!
Okay, but it will be for your life.
Oh, no.
It's gonna have a lot of taxidermied animals, so I guess we'll roll to see if you join them.
Oh, God.
It's just kidding. You can't taxidermy people. Because of the seams.
I feel like that's such a small obstacle.
No, it's the seams.
But like, I don't mind a seam. It's like, I don't know. Like, how much suspension of disbelief are we going for?
Or how good am I at taxidermy?
Yeah, you could cover up a seam.
Or I could just sort of wrap your skin around like a paper towel roll.
Seems rude.
I'm an artist. Even artists.
What I really fear is that you do that and then like you prop me up at my funeral and everybody's like,
she's never looked better.
She looks just like she did.
She's so beautiful.
Alright, hole 5. We pause as the clock spins forward a few more hours. This is when the family managed to get to their cars and get to the nearest police station. They would return with the local force just a few hours later. What happened at the house during this gap is unknown. Nobody stayed because they were scared of aliens. When they returned, no Fair. Member of the party saw the creatures. All investigators could observe were bullet holes, the incredibly high heart rates of the family, and a deeply uneasy feeling about the whole property. Now, that was actually reported by the police who investigated, was that there was, like, a bad feeling.
Weird vibes.
Yeah, so they didn't just, like, roll up, like, oh, what do these dumbasses want? It seems normal. Like, they were like...
Yeah.
They were like,
ooh. Like the police did the time I found a ritual murder location.
Yeah, you and your Girl Scout troop found all those, like, blood-splattered clothes in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
I love that story.
A true thing that happened. And the police were like, I think those are clothes that are, like, dyed from the 70s. And we said, were they dyed with blood? And then they left.
Yeah, we do a lot of bits, but that was a real thing that happened.
It was a real thing that happened.
There was no evidence that anyone had been drinking, which is an important point. But then, quote, another odd item was mentioned by Chief Greenwell. He had finished his search of the immediate premises and had interviewed the family as well as he could in the prevailing confusion. Going into the backyard, he joined a group of men who stood inside the fence, looking out toward the fields and woods where other searchers were moving about with their flashlights. On the outer side of the fence, about where one of the creatures was supposed to have been knocked onto the grass by a gunshot, several men saw a luminous patch roughly 1 to 2 feet in diameter, on the grass. From the side of the fence near the house, the patch was visible from only one angle. Greenwell and others examined the spot carefully, but at close range nothing at all was visible, and the grass didn't seem different in any way. The contrast between the surrounding grass and luminous patch was definite, Chief Greenwell said, about the same magnitude as the contrast between the white background of the topographical map that was on his desk and the brown contour lines of the map.
See, that part is one of the more interesting parts of this story to me, because it seems like maybe there's like a portal, right? Or some sort of residue.
Yeah, that part really stuck with me also. Like, that's so strange. Like, they're clearly, like, grasping to describe something that they couldn't even really visually process. Which makes it very eerie to me. It does make me think of, I feel like I shout out last podcast and Henry Zebrowski on this podcast a lot, which is wrong of me, because, you know.
Nah.
No, it's right. It's so right. But, like, Henry, we love them very much. But Henry has his personal theory that, like, all alien occurrences are the results of, like, a single interdimensional force of strangeness. Like, aliens, Bigfoot, yada yada. Like, it's a far more simple explanation than, like, all these crazy things are happening. It's like there's another reality that overlaps with ours, and the veil is sometimes thin in ways that, like, almost, like, don't mathematically compute. It's like glitches. What? Like, everything strange can be explained with, like, dimensional glitches, according to marijuana-addled Henry Zebrowski. But I do
maybe think of His Dark Materials also. That's how the windows to the other world are described. Mm-hmm. Season 2, I have so much to say about it. And no one to say it to, so I guess Sam has to read all 3 books and then
I actually do want to read the books, so someday you'll get to do that.
Well, when they start doing other worlds, it's described as, like, something you can kind of only barely see from one angle, and that's what it made me think of.
Ooh, that's so creepy. After a few hours of searching, the police finally left the family alone and shaken at around 2 a.m., and then we return back inside the house for holes 5 through 9.
It's a lot of holes. Wink.
So many. Are there that many left? Oh, God.
It's almost like she's had too many weird, milky white Russians.
It's almost like I shouldn't have drank, like, a glass of milk and then a beer for recording of an auditory experience.
We are professionals.
Real pro shit.
Yeah.
The creatures returned. Throughout the night, Mrs. Lankford had been the most self-possessed and observant of those present. It was she who mentioned that the creatures always approached the house slowly, with raised hands, as if they were trying to reassure their hosts or even communicate with them. Had she been able to control the situation, the shooting might have stopped. "I kept telling them to come into the house and shut the doors," she said to me. "The things weren't doing us any harm." Now she looked away and back again 3 times because she thought perhaps her eyes were fooling her. But each time she looked at the window again, the creature was still standing there. She called quietly.
How many hours has it been since it's first started? Has it been a whole day? Like, are they back for the second night is what it is?
No, this is like in the middle of the night after the police investigated. Like, all the same day.
Okay.
This is 2 a.m. The police left. No, this is... It's a little after 2 a.m. It's very shortly after the police left.
So that means the creatures all left when the police were there, but then came back as soon as they were.
Yeah, or they left sometime. It took the family a while to, like, drive into town and come back with the police. So creatures could have left at any time then.
And then they just hate authority figures, as we all should.
Fair. Yeah, fair. And they did come back pretty quickly after the police were gone.
Okay.
She called quietly to the rest of the family to come and look. Lucky, across the room, was on his feet at once. He lifted his gun. "I'm going to shoot," he said. "For God's sake, don't," his mother answered, probably trying to prevent a repetition of the terrified excitement of the earlier visit. Lucky was not persuaded. "Mama, I'm going to shoot that little man," he said, and fired. Kentucky
culture.
That's
for the t-shirt, yeah.
This shot may have been the one that damaged the window frame. In any event, it had no effect on the visitors. None of the shots fired during the second visit injured the creatures any more than the earlier ones had done. Now you gotta mini golf that little man. And then several more times, we're gonna finish out the whole, this is the rest of the fucking game. Holes 5 through 9, you just gotta mini golf that little man, mama.
So am I doing it through the window, is what I'm doing?
Yeah, challenge round.
Oh, alright, go ahead, go spin for me.
Let's see, how many, 5, that's 4, ain't it? Okay. Alright, 3, that's not terrible. That's not terrible for a challenging hole. Mark that down, see what your total par is. Oh, 2. You're getting used to it.
I feel like I'm getting worse at golf.
But you are getting a nice, satisfying, fluorescent flash from his skin each time you hit him. And he does a flip.
So fun!
This one's more like a carnival game.
A window. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to, like, hit a spinning.
Yeah. This one's like a carnival game.
Okay, cool.
Oh, and then another 2.
Okay.
You're pretty good at this. I love how boring this is. I've made this a game for you. It's not fun to listen to. It is fun for us. But,
hey,
you finish that sucker out.
Love audio descriptions of things.
Of rolling dice. Yeah. And you finish that sucker out on a hole in one, baby.
Fuck yeah. Oh, I'm so man. Good at golf.
Adding up to a total par of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 15.
She's forgotten math.
15 for
is that good? I don't know what golf is.
I think that's good for 9 holes of mini golf. I think that's very good. You got like 4 holes in one. That's crazy. Ugh. I think you did great. I'm proud of you.
Okay, great.
God. Okay.
So what's my reward, please?
Hmm?
And for my trophy, please?
Your trophy is the limp carcass of a likely harmless being. Just kidding. They were unharmed by any of the shots.
I'm gonna put him in my room with all the other stuffed creatures.
Yeah, you get a glow in the dark stuffed goblin. Ooh, maybe he'll glow under your blacklight.
Oh, we haven't talked about my.
Yeah, we'll have to yet. We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll end the episode with discussing your new blacklight obsession.
Hey, it's for normal
pervert
reasons.
Pervert.
Okay. All right. So let's.
So you win mini golf. Some museum exhibits. You can win, and this is one of those museum. You won museum. Congrats on winning museum.
I think all exhibits you can do that if you're trying hard enough.
That's true. But now I want to consider amongst ourselves a theory.
Okay.
About what happened that night.
All right. So we're trying to figure out what that actually was.
Yeah. A lot of people are talking. There are people out there that say probably wasn't aliens.
So they're called the Hopkinsville Goblins, even though they're not goblins, which feels like a really specific word, and it's not in Hopkinsville. So altogether, 10 out of 10 for the name.
Yeah, terrible name.
So what do people think? Like aliens or cryptid or what's the deal?
I like the real, like, radio host dinner that you took for that. So, like, what's the deal?
So, like,
you
know, what's the deal?
People are talking, and they want to know. Well, the Hopkinsville Goblins name became the more common way they're referred to later. In the immediate news flurry, like, after the event, they were called the Kelly Creatures. And also they were the reason the term Little Green Men was invented. That was the first time that phraseology was used, was in news articles about these creatures, which is funny because they aren't green at all.
No.
They are kind of like little men, I guess, but they aren't green.
I mean, kind of.
But yeah, as far as we know, that was the first instance of the usage of the phrase Little Green Men, which is neat. And I don't know how they started being called goblins. They were the Kelly Creatures for a while. The Hopkinsville part makes sense as an adjustment because Kelly was such a small town that truly nobody could even find it on a map. So they changed it to Hopkinsville so people could have some approximation of like what and where they were speaking about. But I don't know where the goblin part started. That part is strange.
Like I said, goblin just seems specific.
I think it's
like I like it very much, but
I think it's because they like skitter around. They aren't as like ethereal as other aliens. Mm. I think they're more creaturey.
would be my guess. But there might be a specific reason that I didn't find. But I read about him a lot, and I didn't come across any explanation for that. Anyway, an interesting theory that I a very good two-part podcast that I found about this event was Monster Talk, their episode 167 and I think 168 is about the Hopkinsville encounter. Highly recommend. They talk about Joe Nichols' theory. CSI investigator and goblin enthusiast Joe Nichols and native Kentuckian.
Nothing. Nothing. Oh, it's not a title at all.
Yeah, what I did figure out, because when I read that, I was like, CSI investigator? Does this guy, like, have an actual investigative job? And it stands for Committee for Skeptic Inquiry Investigator.
I think Goblin Enthusiast is an excellent title, though.
I do like that.
I think I told you last time we recorded, I have to make new business cards. Do you think that's what I should put for mine? Just Liz Hamilton, Goblin Enthusiast.
I think you should put Blacklight Dead Bird Pervert, maybe, for accuracy. Just likes to shine black lights on dead birds.
It's for science, kind of. It only worked on one. Come on.
So Joe Nichols believes vehemently that the event was not a hoax, that the family was not lying, and that they believed what they said wholeheartedly. They seemed hysteric, and the bullet holes around their property were very real. But no more than two creatures were ever seen at once, and he thinks the family entered group hysteria due to seeing a mated pair of horned owls, which do share several traits with the goblins.
So we're doing a full the staircase here.
Wait, clue the viewers, like, what is the staircase about?
If you know, you know.
Yeah, if you know, you know. A great horned owl can exceed heights of 2 feet. They are very big birds. And here's a quote from Joe Nichols.
And they have those huge long arms that they run around on.
Yeah, they famously have big skinny arms. Quote from Joe Nichols, "I'm a Kentuckian, and they're just unsophisticated rural people." Which, as also Kentuckian, made me a little bothered. But I also am literally an unsophisticated rural person, so, like, I don't know how much I can knock him.
Nah, you live in the big city now.
If it weren't for the fact that there's a pandemic, I would literally be eating squirrel right now. That's a fun fact.
Okay. I don't know what to do with that.
Nichols draws many comparisons between the witness description and owls, namely these. Large round head, 2.5 feet tall, no neck, large ears, big eyes on the side of the head, which I argue is a fault in his comparison because owls' eyes are not on the side of his head. And owls famously have front-facing eyes, like many other nocturnal predators. And then I go on a big tangent here about how scary it would be if horses have front-facing eyes. I can skip that. I got wild in these notes. But I did end with an anecdote about a horse that me and my mom rescued from a really bad situation because I grew up on a little farm. We took this horse in because he almost starved to death. And supposedly he had to eat the other horse that was in his pen with him to live.
Like, was the other horse still alive or had he died? Like, I don't know which one is worse.
Oh yeah, the other horse had starved to death and died. And they found him slowly eating the carcass of his former stablemate.
Sometimes we tell stories on this podcast, and I think, I don't know if this is relatable.
What is that, alienating?
I don't know if people are listening to this and going like, yeah, they're just like me.
Well, me and my mom had a field, and we looked at that, and we said, free horse.
Well, I guess if you're gonna have a horse, get one who can kill. Who's tasted the flesh of other horse.
But yeah, his name was Smokey, and he was really funny. From then on, like, any time he saw food at all, which was every day, he would get an enormous erection. It was really uncomfortable. I really did not like it. Oh. And once my cousin Garvin Every part of this story is so Kentucky, it's like unbearable. My cousin Garvin, who was staying with us to do farm work, was dumping cat, like he had let some catfish bait go bad. I can't say a single word of this story without it being so Kentuckian.
What is catfish bait?
It's chicken livers.
Okay.
And they'd gone sour.
Yeah, so like he they had, do.
So he dumped them into the yard. And Smokey...
Right, where else are you going to put them?
Yeah, we had let Smokey, like, into the front yard to eat the grass down. And he, like, smelled the rotten chicken livers. And he came running, like, a full gallop. And just started fucking devouring them off of the ground. It was the most depraved thing I've ever seen.
I love that.
So the story was probably true about him eating the other horse, because he got really excited about the smell of rotten meat and immediately started just tearing those fucking chicken livers apart.
Do you guys ever have a rescue pet who gets a huge boner when they sense dead meat?
Email
rotting
us.
Rotting flesh? Yeah, don't.
Shoot us an
or
email.
Do. You know what? It's fine. I pulled a giant water-soaked rat out of my goat's water the other day and fed it to the crows, and they rejected it.
Relatable content from Sam and Liz. So anyway, that was a very Kentucky story. A bit of a digression back to the things that he said made the creatures owl-like. It was said that they didn't turn their heads, and he said this was another similarity they had to owls, which again, I would contend is the opposite of true.
Right! That's famously, they move their necks.
Yeah, they have like the widest circumference of neck rotation of any animal, famously.
Except for me.
Except for Liz, who's actually facing away from her computer right now, except for her
but
head.
But my mouth is still pointing that way. It's wild.
It's gross. I'm glad that this is just a podcast and you don't have to see it. So Nickel kind of disregards his discrepancies in this description. But as a Kentuckian himself, I'm going to absolve him from his doubt about the validity of their stories based on like where they're from. A lot of people, when they're talking about the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter, are pretty mean to the witnesses, calling them like rednecks and hillbillies, which is a common thing. You know, people don't take us rednecks seriously. I get it.
Yep,
but, like,
it's bullshit.
You know. We are crazy, but we're not liars, generally.
No, also, it doesn't, there's so many details to the story that doesn't...
It would be a crazy thing to make up.
Right, also, like, I've never, like, I feel like you'd know if it was an owl, if you lived in the country.
Oh, you would absolutely, oh yeah, they've probably eaten a fucking owl before. They live in, that's not true. Rednecks don't eat owls. But you see a lot of them. You've probably,
right.
Okay, if you grew up...
Also, owls are loud as fuck. Like it would not be surprising.
If you grew up in rural Kentucky, you've had at least one physical fight with an owl by the time you're 19. It's a rite of passage. I've never fought with an owl. I have touched an owl. Once me and my mom were driving
sexually?
No. Gross. Me and my mom were driving by a field, and there was one just sitting in the middle of the field. And my mom's usually, like... You know, not really a mess around fun type, but I was like, Mom, please pull over the truck so I can touch that owl.
Mom, I gotta touch that owl.
And she was like, yeah, that makes sense. So she just pulled the truck over and I like touched the owl and then he flew away. So he was fine. But that was crazy.
Cool.
Bad story, but anyway,
no, I loved it.
If you're a redneck, you know what an owl looks like deep in your soul. You're very aware of
what
an owl
looks
like.
Like.
I did get in a fight with a hawk once, though. It was on the middle of
That's
campus.
Fine.
It's in the middle of campus. A bunch of people
stared
at me.
It was targeting you specifically.
Oh, no, no. It didn't come to me.
You were just screaming at it?
I initiated the fight. It was in front of Willie T. Library. Have I told this story on the podcast before?
No, I've never heard a story about you fighting a hawk in front of the library. It sounds, frankly, like a story I would tell, so I'm very thrilled to hear it.
Okay, so that was, like, it was right in front of Willie T, like, in the bowl. So, like, at any time in the middle of the day, there's, like, 100 people, like, walking to and from class.
Yep.
It's the complete epicenter of the campus of the University of Kentucky. And there was, like, a hole full of baby rabbits. And everybody was gathered, like, I didn't know that. Everybody was gathered around this hawk that was in the middle of the, like, the bowl in front of Willie T. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to go stare at the hawk with be late for class.
Yeah, obviously.
And it was because it was just decimating this den full of baby rabbits. And they were just, they were all screaming bloody murder. And everybody was, like, watching in, like, sick horror. And it was the worst thing ever. And I personally, I don't believe in interfering with nature. If a hawk wants to eat some baby bunnies, well, that's not my business. But what I don't like is having to watch it happen.
Right.
So I parted the crowd like Noah, and I moved toward the hawk and began flapping my arms and screeching, while just a bunch of other, like, you know, normal, healthy 20-year-olds watched on in abject horror of several varieties. And the hawk, like, sort of came at me a little bit, and I, like, smacked it. Not hard. I just I just gave him, like, a good little, like, side swipe.
Yeah.
And he flew away, and he dropped. I did save at least one bunny, because he dropped on the ground. And then it like, scurried back into the little hole it had been inside. And then I just turned around, and I looked at the crowd, and I just, I feel like I shrugged, but I didn't say anything. There was nothing to say, and nobody else said anything. Like, they're, like, circle of, like, 10 people, like, nobody was like,
well, it seems wild that no one did anything. I'd punch a hawk if it was attacking baby bunnies.
Yeah, I punched a hawk.
I mean, that seems like a crazy place for a rabbit to leave baby bunnies, honestly. It's the weirdest part of the story.
It was weird that they were there. It was a hole. Like, it was like, right, it was like, but I don't know, it was weird. And it wasn't a punch. I didn't punch the hawk. It was more of an open-handed slap. And I didn't hurt it, but and he got one. He made off with one, and he dropped one. I've told a lot of stories in this episode that sound fake. I swear to God, that's just what living in Kentucky is like.
Yeah. Also, just what you're like,
and also just things that happen to me.
Oh, so wait, so back to the owl. We haven't.
Yeah, we're way off.
Our blacklight portion of the story.
Oh yeah,
a scientific update.
Okay, I'm excited. Okay. So, I'll give Nicol the benefit of a doubt on his theory, because I as a Kentuckian, I think he at least isn't completely discrediting them out of bias against, like, Southern people. Like, not Southern right. people, but, like, redneck people. That's a right. specific type of bias. Another thing, he explains the fact that the creature just had arms and hands as the way the owl's arms, quote, look thin from the front by their wings. Like, if you're looking at just the front edge of the wing, they can look skinny, which I did look up pictures, and I could see that. But, like, this happened for hours. They would have seen them from another angle at some point.
Also, like, birds move like birds.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
and again, they lived in Western Kentucky. They know what an owl looks like. Right. And so they also pointed out that the way they walked awkwardly on, quote, broom handle legs was owl-like. And the floating...
I should have brought my owl legs in to show you. I just got some in from Japan. We could have acted this out.
Why are we like this?
I don't know.
We make me sick.
I cleaned the little legs with a toothbrush yesterday.
Oh, God. The fact that they could float once even 40 feet from the roof to the fence is also similar to the way that owls can glide and sort of float from treetops to the ground. So I'll give him that.
Right.
Birds but again, fly, it was 1955 and not a delusional 1700s witch hunt. So right. I don't know how those people couldn't know what owls were over the course of hours. And also having an interim in the middle to sort of calm down.
Where one of them would have said, was that an owl?
Yeah. Yeah, like, I don't know. Group hysteria, I usually don't like those theories. Sometimes they make, like, in this case, it especially doesn't make sense. And there is the glowing, shining, which Nicol attributes to the owls being pale. And then the host of Monster Talk mentioned could be, in part due to owls actually have, the fact that owls actually have a minor bioluminescence.
Yeah.
Which is, really interesting. Or wait, no, I misspoke. The hosts of the podcast point out that the glowing residue they found on the ground might have been foxfire, a fungus that is found very rarely. Also doesn't look like a residue. It's more of a fully formed fungus that can softly glow from a distance.
I mean, You and I talked about how owls, if you put a black light on owls, they do produce like a bioluminescence. A lot of birds do.
Yeah.
And that's how they age a lot of owls, because the newer feathers will have much brighter ones. But, yeah. Like, they didn't have a black light, and that doesn't, that's not something that human eyes can see otherwise.
All right, our eyes don't pick it up at all.
But I did want to test that theory, and, about birds, sort of phosphorescent.
Yeah, Liz got really obsessed with this after our first recording, which I knew she would, and I was very excited to share this fact with her.
Again, this is our least relatable episode. I recently bought a puffin, and I wanted to see how it... if it glowed or not, because they're some of the glowier birds. They produce a lot. And this puffin, it's actually a really new piece of taxidermy. A relatively new. And it did glow. And it didn't produce, like, a super bright glow when I bought a black light. But it made some exciting colors. So I'll put that on Instagram, because I took a picture and sent it to Sam. But, like, some of my other pieces didn't. Like, the starlings didn't. I have some starlings, and starlings are supposed to. So I don't know if it had to do with, like the age of the piece or chemicals it was being treated with, but I got one of them to do it. So, but if you have any live puffins around you, you could shine a black light on them. It's mostly their beak that does it.
Puffin.
Hmm?
I really wanted that puffin to glow.
It did glow. I sent you the picture.
Oh, shit. That's right.
Yeah. At first I couldn't get it to do it, but then there was like a specific angle I could hold it at.
Okay. Weird.
Where I did get it to phosphoresce.
Weird.
But it, like, so the old pieces I have, because I mostly work with, like, antique taxidermy, those gave off nothing, because they're, like, dirty and been in the sun and been around smoke, but that, which I think is my newest piece, did, so.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So a fun experiment, if you, like me, have a bedroom full of dead birds. So I'll post the picture. We have derailed fantastically towards the end here.
I don't mean to rag on Nickel listening to him. I could recognize the unmistakable Kentucky lilt in his voice, and I found it very cozy. He's a great speaker. But it just doesn't line up. I think I pretty much discount his theory. I think these people would have known.
That it was an owl?
Owls, yeah. The host of Monster Talk, Blake Smith, also appreciated Nickel's theory, but did not concede to it. He pointed out the descriptor of the goblins being, quote, like washtubs. Something that wasn't covered in this theory or in any popular depictions of the creatures. They're always drawn as very skinny, when they're in fact, like, kind of stocky, weird little, like, blocky creatures. A quote from Nickel, "These hapless people ran afoul of a couple of owls, and the owls ran afoul of some people, and nobody knew what the hell was going on, and owls behaved like owls, and people behaved like people, and they never came to one accord."
Okay. So I'm gonna go ahead and agree that I don't think it was an owl. So that leaves us with what, like, cryptid or ghost or alien? Like, what?
I like dimensional rift.
Yeah. I mean, I like dimensional rift in any.
Pretty much, yeah, for all things. That's why I like it. It's a complete cure-all. I also just want to point out that, like, a lot of discourse around the Kelly creatures leads to really disparaging words about Kentuckians, which is unfair. And, you know, sometimes we know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who is not from Kentucky but lived there for many years, people said a lot of real fucked up bullshit about Kentucky to me, and that really seems like their problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like, I had relatives who acted like I was getting a graduate degree at, like, a big professional university, and I was teaching other people, and they acted every time like I was teaching pigs to read, like, in a field. And I'm like, no, it's like a real school, like...
Yeah, people really think of it that way. Yeah, so this is me at the end of the podcast giving in my positive word for Kentuckians. We are poor, we're a very disenfranchised state, even a horse is free here. You know, like, that's when you know the economy's messed up, when you can just get a free horse. I don't know. We're very disadvantaged as a state, and I don't know, just think people could give us a little more credit. And we know an alien when we see it. I just found myself getting emotional about that element of the story as myself, a a poor, disgruntled Kentuckian redneck.
Well, I think that kind of, like, regionalism is super unchecked by a lot of people here. Like, thinking about Kentucky and West Virginia.
Yeah, it's wild.
Like, that as being...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those two especially.
Right, and it has so much to do with, like, politics and economics than it does anything else. Like, it's just, it's such nonsense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Kentucky's got a lot of problems. I don't like that we're a red state. We have an incredible, insane amount of endemic racism, but so do other states that don't get called idiots, like, as a rule. And the difference is largely that those states have money. Yeah. Just my soapbox moment for this episode.
I agree with that soapbox.
Yeah, my only ending note was owl facts.
Yeah, give me some owl facts.
Which is that owls glow pink under a black light.
I would strongly suggest looking at pictures of it. It's really interesting.
It's beautiful. It's really exciting. We should post some.
Yeah, and it's really great to see the ways that that's actually used in the field to be productive with owls.
Oh, here's a quote from a study I got on it. Quote, most, this is from, I'll include the source later when we aggregate all our sources, which we are going to do eventually.
Listen.
But if you're ever wondering about a specific source in the meantime, you can contact us, because we're in the process of making a website where we aggregate all of these things. Quote, most owl species have fluorescent wings, a quirk that was also discovered accidentally by rat researcher Bruce Colvin in the early 1980s. Colvin, who had fed rats fluorescent material as part of an unrelated experiment, was shining a black light on owl pellets and looking for glowing rodent bones when he noticed that the owls glowed too. He quickly figured out that the fluorescence in the wing feathers correlates with the age of the feathers. New feathers glow brightly, while older ones have lost some of their pigments and so appear darker or duller under the black light. Now most researchers who band and track owls take a moment to check their age. It's a combination of serious ornithology and a cheap party trick, he adds. You turn off the lights, you turn on the black light, and you show the owl's wings, and it's glowing raspberry pink. Other owls, he adds, shine a deep blue or lavender instead. And snowy owls, lacking the correct pigment, don't glow at all.
Wild!
Yeah.
Weirdly, the thing that glowed the most in my collection of animal parts were coyote feet glowed the most, but I don't know why.
That is super weird. I wonder if those were, like, treated with something.
They could have. They're tanned, but they glowed so brightly. It was
I'll have to
spooky.
Google that later.
I did no research as to why. I just amused myself by shining my flashlight on them. You know, like science.
Additional fun facts. The Hopkinsville Goblins inspired the Pokemon Sableye, which, if you're a nerd, is a really fun fact. Congrats, nerds, on how much fun you're having with that fact right now.
Don't means nothing.
I was a Pokemon kid. I know Sableye. Okay. He's a little purple guy. He looks like he's made out of rocks.
Okay.
And the Kelly community now celebrates the anniversary of the event on the third weekend of every August with an event called Kelly Little Green Men Days.
Fun. How did they celebrate that? I imagine that would be very exciting to go to.
I need to look into it more. I didn't look into it while I was researching this because I was so bummed out that, like, it didn't happen this year, I'm pretty sure.
Aww.
And I was, like, sad about it. But I'd like to look more. I love small town festivals centered around legends. Like, it's my dream to go to the Mothman Festival at some point.
Yeah.
I've been to the Mothman Museum. That was silly.
The tiny town where I live, every year, they don't celebrate Halloween because they're good Christians or something.
Mm.
But they have something that they call Scarecrow Days, where every year they keep
that's
adding
horrifying.
More and more scarecrows to this field, and they're all dressed in regular clothes. And I assume it's a testament to all the people who they've fed to the Wicker Man every year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like,
it's horrifying.
It's so eerie, and they just keep adding more of them to this one field. So don't come here. Not because of that reason, but it's bad.
That is horrifying.
Yeah, I hate it.
That wraps up my exhibit. I hope you enjoyed learning about the Hopkinsville Goblins.
I did, and I enjoyed the golf, and I enjoyed all of it. It was great.
The glowing.
I did
dark.
Love the glowing part. That was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I didn't know I loved blacklight until I bought one.
Next time we see each other, you have to bring it.
It was like $8 on Amazon.
Oh, maybe I'll just get one.
Yeah, I bought a
flashlight.
I don't
have anything. I hope
that
I
you
don't
know
have
of that
glows.
I bet your creatures would glow because cotton thread glows.
Oh, that's right. We use this. Mm-hmm. We both use the cotton thread from the fiber shop a lot of the time. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or did you also steal a bunch of that before you graduated?
Yeah, I stole a ton of it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Personally, purged all of the cotton thread that was used for medical dressing.
It's the best thread I've ever used. Really, I don't know what I'm gonna do when I run out of it.
Yeah, I don't know if I have any.
We'll have to find more. It was so good. Anyway, thank you for listening to the Museum of the Vanishing Dog.
Sorry it took so long for us to get ourselves together.
Hey, we're back
hopefully
though.
It'll be a shorter distance till the next episode, I hope.
Probably.
who knows? I wanted to say, as we wrapped up, that if you were looking for a way to support museums right now, especially because a lot of the country is closed back down, and probably will stay closed for a while, go ahead and buy some stuff from their gift shop.
Yeah. They have such fun things.
Yeah. I just bought a great sweatshirt from the Mutter Museum, and I sent Sam a bunch of stuff from the Bob Baker Marionette Theater here in Los Angeles. Because they're having a really hard time. But I think it's the same for, like, zoos and aquariums, like, all kinds of institutions that are really struggling.
You know who has a great gift shop is the Museum of Jurassic Technology.
It is the best gift shop, yeah. So, best museum, best gift shop.
And they've got an online gift shop. It's a weird old Angel Fire website, but it's there. It's
spectacular.
My favorite mug ever.
Yeah.
It's from there.
Yeah, so that would be a great way to support a museum.
Also an interesting museum to read about if you've never been during this time that you can't go. There's some cool books and stuff about them. They have a fun website. Big inspiration for this podcast. And this institution, the Museum of the Vanishing Dog, is the Museum of Jurassic Technology. Highly recommend looking into it. Also, I highly recommend following our Instagram at Vanishing Dogs. Follow Liz at Liz Hamilton. That's Liz with two Z's.
Yep, spell see it her.
That's where you can see all of her very
birds?
Spooky dead art. And
I'm gonna talk in my next episode at length about taxidermy.
I'm very excited. You're an expert now. You've become a veritable expert.
Follow
me at Sam Sketchbook. You can see the weird things that I do. Weird, strange,
different, but
robot grotesquerie. And follow the musical artist who did our theme song and outro, Greta Russell, at noise_wife.
Greta's the best.
She has a new album.
Yeah.
You should check it out.
Definitely.
People Are Grass. Find it on SoundCloud.
Yeah.
Give her money.
Do it. Give her lots of money. She deserves it.
Now get out of here.
Yeah, all right. Sorry, you're cursed. Sorry.
The museum's closed.
Sorry.
And you're cursed. Bye.
Bye.